Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. My guest today is Professor Eugene Volkow, who is Professor of Law at UCLA. He teaches First Amendment Law at UCLA. Welcome, Eugene.
Good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So I got some of your papers, and I want to start with free speech rules, free speech culture, and legal education, in which you say the arguments in favor of protecting free speech, of suppressing attempts to disrupt speech, and of deliberately promoting debate, even on the most controversial of issues, are strong in many contexts. They're particularly strong in universities generally, whatever subjects they teach, and of course in public debate more broadly. So I often do this, Eugene. I take the opposite position just to create a debate. We always had a debating culture, right? I would imagine the debating culture was probably stronger in UK, but my perception is that I grew up in India. So my perception is that in the US, we always had a debating culture, and the university provides a very interesting environment for this to happen, right? So what is your thesis here?
Well, so these days, there still is a good deal of debate in many places, including universities and law schools, but increasingly people have been trying to reduce that amount of debate by saying certain subjects are off limits for discussion because they're particularly offensive or particularly wrongheaded. So, for example, my sense is that it's pretty difficult to find debate on questions such as gender identity, whether transgender athletes should be allowed in women's sports. And when I tried to put on such a talk on the subject by a noted sports law scholar, there was a disruption of it where people were shouting her down for the first 5 minutes, and the administration did nothing to stop that. I think that that's bad, but that is happening. My sense is that it's also very difficult to have debate on various other subjects having to do with race and policing, or having to do with affirmative action, or a variety of other issues. It's not impossible. There are such discussions that happen. It's just hard. Partly because of risk of some sort of administrative pushback, part of it because of risk of disruption, part of it, perhaps most insidious of all, is that people are afraid to bring up these subjects for fear that they're going to be ostracized by their classmates or just otherwise looked down on. And of course, the First Amendment protects people's right to ostracize other people for their views. That's what makes it so hard to deal with this. But the problem is that if that's the culture that emerges, that's going to be very bad for education, for public debate generally, but also for education, and in particular for legal education. Remember, in legal education, we're training lawyers, and the lawyer's job is to understand not just the arguments for his side, but the arguments for the other side too. It's often said you need to understand the other side's arguments better than they do themselves. So if people's reaction is, well, no, some subjects, some arguments are so bad that we shouldn't be discussing them, we shouldn't be focusing on them, well, then the consequence is you're not going to be a very good lawyer, not going to be very effective for your clients.
Yeah, so I don't know much about the Constitution, Eugene. So the First Amendment, it seems like it's a very broad intellectual argument, you know, basically saying, if you don't have free speech, if you cannot go out and talk about what you strongly feel about, then we cannot really advance. So, you know, we could come to a grinding halt in some ways, right? So if I can't say anything about something that offends somebody, and we could come to a sort of a grinding halt in the public square, right? Is that the issue?
I'm sorry, I wish I, there may be something off about my speakers, but we would come to a what in the public?
So it's so sort of a grinding halt, I would say.
Oh, grinding
halt.
In terms
of sort of, you know,
I don't want to overstate matters. I don't want to overstate matters. Even in countries where there is a good deal more restriction on speech than there is in the U.S., you know, it's not like we've come to a grinding halt in public debate. Public debate progresses. It's just it becomes a lot harder to discuss really important issues. If you can't talk about immigration, then it becomes a lot harder to come up with sensible policy in immigration.
Yeah.
If you can't talk about race in public policy, whether you're talking about it from the left or the right or from some other place, then you can't have a serious analysis of what is to be done. And even if you're quite confident that one particular position is correct, you need to be able to hear the other side's position, if only to understand, look, there are other fellow citizens, other fellow voters who disagree with you, and this is why they disagree with you, and then you might figure out how to persuade them. But if you can't understand what other people believe, because they're not allowed to say it, or if they do say it, they're threatened with firing, or otherwise they're discouraged from saying it, it becomes very difficult to have sensible democratic debates. Not impossible, just a lot more difficult.
A lot more difficult. So the neurologists and neuroscientists that who came in the show, they generally tell me that, you know, the brain is, it sort of want to believe certain things, and it's very difficult to change one's position, typically. I don't know if it used to be the case, actually, in debate. Well, I don't know if that happens in debate, because both parties are sort of married to their assumptions and conclusions. But it used to be that in conversations, you know, we could move people to think about something different. But I don't think it's happening that much anymore. What is your perception?
You know, I'm always skeptical about claims that things have gotten worse or that they've gotten better, right? In order to know whether there's, for example, less tendency for people to change their views now than before, we need to know how often they change their views now. Very hard to measure. And we need to know how often they did 20 years ago. Also very hard to measure. We have some memories of that, but those memories are going to be affected by all sorts of biases, right? We only observed a very small fraction of what's going on. We may have misremembered it, or may have forgotten a lot of it. And the things that we remember about what happened 20 years ago might just be our remembering the best parts of what was going on 20 years ago, or the worst parts for that matter. So I'm always skeptical about claims that things have changed for the better or worse. I will say, on the one hand, it's human nature not to want to change your views, partly because you came to your views for some reason. That reason is probably going to endure. On top of that, changing your views might be kind of embarrassing for you, especially if you have publicly asserted and defended those views. It's possible, for example, that the very fact that there is social media now where people write things and therefore kind of commit themselves in their minds to something they've after all published to the world, may be less likely to be open to changing their views. Although I should stress again, I don't know for sure, but that's one, that's a possibility. But even in the absence of that, it's people would prefer to think that they were right all along. So that's human nature. At the same time, if we look backwards at our own lives and the lives of many other people, most people have changed their views on some subjects or another. So, for example, there's been a massive change in views with regard to sexual orientation towards things like gay marriage and the like. And I think on balance, actually, I like those views. I think some of them may have gone too far. But on balance, I think that that things have developed quite well in greater tolerance for sexual minorities. But at the same time, you know, some of it may just be old generation dying, new generation replacing, but I don't think that's it. Yeah. I know that I've changed my views in some measure on this. I think lots of other people did too. So there's the possibility of changing views. Any particular statement may be very unlikely to change someone's view. Yeah. Again, looking forward, you might think the probability of this statement changing someone's view is very small. But looking backward, we know that some things have managed to persuade people to change their views and are likely to continue doing so. So I do think there's room for persuasion and room for maybe kind of nudging people in a particular direction. How that is to be effectively done, that's always a challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Have you looked at any sort of cross-country data? Do we see any variation across the 200 countries that we have?
So the answer is I have not looked at them. It may be that people have studied that. My guess is it's pretty hard to study even in one country, much less in 200, some of which people may be quite reluctant to answer. Survey takers, some of which people may not have the phones to answer them with. You know, it's hard enough to get information in America, where there was a very well-developed polling culture. I'd be skeptical of claims about things in other countries. And even if it's well-gathered in each country, it may be difficult to compare them because people's understanding of the question may vary from country to country.
Yeah, so I was thinking about this, you know, so from a sort of a scientific perspective, I would say, you know, there's a set of assumptions, and then you use some sort of hypothesis testing on those assumptions, and you reach a conclusion. Suppose I can reach this, suppose I can change the assumptions, then if you're using some sort of a scientific process, then your conclusions will change quite dramatically. And so the issue is, are we, you know, is the general public using a scientific process to go to conclusions from assumptions?
No, because they're not scientists. They're not using process of legal reasoning because they're not lawyers. I mean, I'm not saying that as a pejorative. You cannot expect people who are outside your field to think that, to use the tools of your field. They use the tools of their fields. Now, maybe your tools are better, but the reality is we can never rest our political system on the assumption that everybody's going to be a scientist, because they're not scientists. I'm not sure it would be great if everybody were a scientist, but in any event, they're not.
So changing the assumptions don't really help you. So
I think I see a conflict.
Yeah,
not at all.
Go ahead, sorry. Yeah.
No. You're right that scientists have a particular way of reasoning from assumptions to results. We might think of it as a scientific method. But ordinary people also may reason not the way scientists do, but they do reason about various things. It's generally believed that sometimes presenting some particular facts or presenting some particular stories, hopefully accurate stories, to people may in fact change their views, right? Mm. So for example, in the context of gay rights, the assumption was that if you present lots of normal seeming gay people, and I don't mean normal as a positive necessarily or as a negative, I just mean people who are interested in pretty much the same things that most people are interested in. Hmm. Having a good job, having friends, having a family. Maybe they, obviously, if they're of the same sex, they can't produce a family just through sex, but there are lots of other ways of producing a family. I think that helped affect people's views of the subject. For example, it's conventionally thought, and whether it's true or not, I don't know, but that when gay rights issues were, we want to join the Boy Scouts. Why? Because we appreciate all the values of the Boy Scouts. We just don't agree with what we think is a very secondary and perhaps extraneous value of moral straightness in the way of accepting heterosexuality as the proper thing. We want to join the military. We want to help fight for our country. You know, I think that's going to change people's assumptions about gays. Or we want to have families. We want to get married so that we can raise children. You know, a lot of people will say, well, that's not the way I'm, that I would produce my children. But, you know, in many ways, it's very similar. Again, changing assumptions. On the other hand, it's generally thought that some other aspects that have been historically associated with gay culture, like, for example, fairly sexualized parades and events at gay bars or at other kinds of gay events, things that I think everybody should be perfectly free to engage in. I'm not faulting people who want to engage in that, but it's generally thought that that was not the kind of thing that would lead people to say, oh, yes, you know, we should accept homosexuality as kind of morally equivalent to heterosexuality. Maybe people should have completely ignored that. Maybe they should have thought through these things as scientists. Although, of course, speaking of scientists, psychologists, up until 1974, accepted homosexuality as a mental illness, right? Yeah, so it's not clear that scientists had a particularly better approach to this. But in general, I do think people's assumptions changed and people's conclusions changed.
Yeah, so what I'm gathering also, Eugene, is that it's also a communication issue, right? So what I sort of observe sometimes is that scientists are especially bad at this. Economists are also quite bad at this, which is they have a position and they can't quite not explain it, but they can really have a flexible attitude. I think this is, in some sense, you know, this is what you're saying. You have to put yourself in the other person's shoes to really understand where they're coming from. And most scientists and technologists are typically unwilling to do that. And so they become really bad communicators. That's my hypothesis.
Well, you know, it's possible. I used to be a computer programmer. We were notorious for being bad communicators. And I think that's just because we never learned how to write well or write English language well. Other things were prioritized. We were very good programmers, much better than the good writers. But the good writers were better writers than us programmers. So that was just it wasn't so much even an attitudinal thing. It was just kind of a lack of experience. But it is true, at least it shouldn't say it's true. It seems quite plausible to me that when you mostly argue through syllogism or through mathematical proof or through particular inferences from particular classes of evidence, you may become very good at arguing that way, but be a good deal less experienced and arguing based about other things where the standards of proof and evidence are different, in part because you can't really do, let's say, blind control. So I'll give you an example. One field that I've studied is gun policy.
Yeah.
You know, it would be nice if we could have a nice double-blind experiment, right? Divide the country in half, have different rules for each half, not tell either half which half they're in, and then come back 5 years later, 10 years, 20 years later, and see what the results are, right? Of course, so the way I describe it, it sounds like almost a parody of scientific methods, because, of course, you can't do a double-blind experiment with public policy. But that's just a reminder that if what you're acquainted with is the way that people do physics or mathematics or even chemistry or perhaps biology, it's maybe those tools won't tell you as much about public policy. This having been said, I do think that people can be moved on this subject. So one, for example, important data point that I think when I've talked about it, people really notice is a number. It's about 400 million. And that's the number of guns that people estimate. We don't know for sure there are in the U.S. Well, if you think there are only 10 million guns or 40 million guns, you might say, well, if we just ban guns, maybe, you know, the small fraction of people who have a gun will give them up and the others we can kind of take the guns from them or threaten them with prison. You could say that. On the other hand, 400 million, that's more than one per American, right? Almost half of all American households have a gun. If you could wave your magic wand, which unfortunately we don't have in public policy, and cause 90% of all those guns to disappear, that would be an extraordinarily high effectiveness for any ban. That would be 40 million guns. That's enough to satisfy the needs of America's criminal population for a very long time, especially since guns last a long time. So that's an important data point. Another thing about war on drugs, I think, you know, I'm not sure how much this has affected people, but I imagine that people are in some measure affected by seeing how unsuccessful the war on drugs has been. Some economists, actually, and public policy people frame it in a very particular way. They ask, you know, what's the street price of various drugs? And if the street price of various drugs has not materially changed as a result of extra enforcement, that tells us that the enforcement just isn't successful. But more broadly, I think people are seeing, look, you know, maybe if, again, we could wave our magic wand, there's going to be no more cocaine, no more heroin, no more methamphetamines, maybe no more marijuana, maybe no more alcohol. The world would be a better place, but we know that that's not the way things happen. Now, not everybody's moved by this. And of course, when it comes to the war on drugs, the war on marijuana seems largely over and marijuana has won. But as to other drugs, it is continuing in considerable measure. And maybe I'm wrong in having come around, having been persuaded that drug prohibition is probably not a great idea. But I do think that people listen, people pay attention to things that they see, maybe not a particular argument, but kind of the steady drumbeat of evidence. Of course, sometimes it's poor quality evidence. Sometimes it's filtered through a media environment, which is biased in various ways, whether ideologically biased or biased towards certain kinds of information, just because it seems to draw more eyeballs. But I do think that people are potentially persuadable if you come up with the right evidence married to the right kind of argument that works for them.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't have the numbers, Eugene, but didn't Australia, going back to the gun policy question, didn't Australia effectively take away 75% of the guns in the country or something like that?
So I very much doubt that it was 75%. There was this experiment. Some people say that this had been followed by a substantial decline in crime. Some people said it was actually not followed by any decline in crime as a result of this, that this is just a continued, the crime rate change was continued from before that. But look, first of all, Australia is a smaller country. But beyond that, and it's also an island, essentially, island continent, but beyond that, let's assume you could get rid of 75% of all American guns. Just using the number you gave me, 100 million guns would be left. Guns are not like cocaine. When you use it once, you don't need to buy a new one. Guns can last 100 years. So with 100 million guns in America, what would happen? Well, they'd become somewhat more expensive. Ordinary law-abiding people, especially poor people, would find it harder to buy a gun. Obviously, criminals and gangsters for whom the gun is a tool of the trade will pay what needs to be paid. So I'm not sure, even if you are right, that you can cause 75% to go away. And I can tell you, there are a lot of law-abiding gun owners who will simply stop being law-abiding if you try to ban their guns. They're going to say no, and they're going to essentially cut themselves off from the legal system and essentially view the legal system as illegitimate and as oppressive as a result. You know, maybe figure that's okay, but that is one possible cost. So I don't think you're going to get 75% removal. But again, even if you do, 100 million guns will be left. I'm not sure how much of an improvement that would lead to in the crime rate.
Yeah, and thinking more about it, there could also be a bias selection problem here, because the guns taken away would be sort of good guns.
Right, gun code. Exactly.
And the 100 million bad guns will remain in the system.
Right. And the people who are likely to give up their guns are going to be disproportionately people who are law-abiding, who have a lot to lose from being caught with an illegal gun, for whom the gun is not a tool of their trade. So those are the people who are least likely to abuse them. And if you're talking about people who are again gang members, there's a tremendous amount of gun crime stems from essentially criminals, career criminals, you know, that'd be pretty foolish to give up their guns, right? Mm. Because their opposing gang isn't going to give up their guns, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tool for their job, really. Exactly. So, I mean, if I give up my gun as a gang member, what do I have? Not a lot more. And so I want to go into another paper, which I'm very, very interested in, Eugene. So freedom of speech and AI artificial intelligence output.
Mm-hmm.
So you say here's the output of generative AI entitled to First Amendment protection. We are inclined to say yes, even though current AI programs are, of course, not people and do not themselves have constitutional rights. Their speech may potentially be protected because of the rights of the program's creators. But beyond that, and likely more significantly, you say AI program speech should be protected because of the rights of their users, both the users' rights to listen and the rights to speak. I never thought about this, Eugene. So we have generative AI really taking off. ChatGPT, there are rumors about ChatGPT-5 that looks almost like a human. So what is the Constitution, obviously, the founders never thought about generative AI. It's
true.
The Constitution can really think about this in this context. So what would be the interpretation of what we have in the law?
Right. So I think that probably the output of generative AI programs is constitutionally protected. I appreciate that it's not open and shut, because you could say, look, you know, the purpose of the First Amendment is to protect the rights of people. No, sometimes it protects the rights of groups of people, it protects the rights of corporations, of newspapers, of unions. But those things are still people, organizations of people who speak through people, whereas AI output is just the output of a computer. Computers don't have rights. Why should there be protection for that? Well, there are, I think, at least three possible explanations. One is, sure. I think there are three ways in which AI output might be protected. One way, which I think is the most important way, is that the First Amendment protects the rights of listeners and readers, and not just the rights of speakers. So let me give you two examples, one from a real case and one from something that's so obvious that there hasn't even been a case on the subject. So back in 1965, there was a case called Lamont v. Postmaster General, which involved a federal statute that said essentially that foreign communist propaganda cannot be delivered into the U.S. unless the recipient says that they want to get it.
Mm.
Now, it's not clear that foreigners shipping things from foreign countries have any First Amendment rights. What's more, much of this foreign propaganda came from foreign governments. And it seems very unlikely that a foreign government has First Amendment rights in things that they send from overseas.
Yeah.
But American recipients have the First Amendment right to read. And that's why the Supreme Court struck down the law. It said that basically by requiring people to identify themselves as willing readers of communist propaganda, the law interfered with the rights of readers. Let me give you another example. Let's say the government says, you know, we just don't like the works of Aristotle or of Galileo, and we're going to prohibit the distribution of those works. As people say, well, what about free speech rights? They say, Aristotle is dead, so is Galileo. We're not threatening to throw them in jail. Beyond our authority. What's more, they're foreigners writing in foreign places. Why should they have any First Amendment rights? But on top of that, they wrote long before there even was a First Amendment, right? All of these reasons, people would laugh at that. Why would they laugh at that? Now, one possible answer, I think it's the strongest answer, is that Americans have the right to read the works of Aristotle, Galileo, Karl Marx, Machiavelli, Adolf Hitler, all of these people who are dead. They may be dead, but Americans are alive and they're entitled to read them. Now, there are other ways you can approach the matter. You could say, well, Americans have the right to republish those works. So it's all about the rights of American publishers, maybe. But I think the real reason that we would think it's a First Amendment violation for the government to try to interfere with the republication of works by dead authors is because of the interest of the living readers, not of the people who happen to want to republish them. I think the same thing would apply to AI output, that AI output may be of quite great value to readers. A related point is that AI output also is a mechanism for people to write. It's a tool for writing. That's, I think, one thing that people often use it for. Now, sometimes it may be in a deceptive way. For instance, if you write your high school essay using it, if you delegate that to ChatGPT, that would be bad. But it doesn't have to be, right? People can write, say, some blog post, right? Asking it to come up with a draft, or write some promotional material, ask it to come up with a draft, and then edit it, of course. But it's an important tool. So it's just like, you know, are typewriters protected by the First Amendment? Well, it's not like the typewriter has First Amendment rights. It's not like typewriter companies had First Amendment rights as such. They were just really important tools for people to write. Well, AI is another such tool. And one other thing that AI is it's a tool for gathering information. So you might say that it's not like a typewriter, it's like a camera. And there have been lower court cases, not Supreme Court cases, but several lower court cases all over the country, which have said, look, if somebody is standing on the street, photo recording or video recording things, photographing or video recording things, especially police activity, that's where a lot of these things, these cases have arisen, they're exercising their First Amendment rights, not because the camera itself produces speech, although you might say that because the output is speech, it's because it facilitates people's speech by gathering information in a way that has verisimilitude. So if you just say, I saw the police officer do something, people might say, well, did you, didn't you? Are you lying? Did you misperceive? But if you show a video, then people are much more likely to be persuaded. So likewise, AI software is a mechanism for gathering information. I think it's often pretty good at basically gathering information from its training data and aggregating into something. Now, it's not always trustworthy. It often hallucinates. It's often false. But, you know, that's true of a lot of speech, right? Newspapers aren't always trustworthy. Certainly tweets aren't always trustworthy. So I think for all these reasons, I do think that AI output has a strong claim to First Amendment protection. Not the AI, because it's not a rights holder. But the users of AI, it would violate their First Amendment rights to block them, especially in viewpoint-based ways, block them from using AI for various purposes.
Yeah, so if I understand this correctly, Eugene, so the First Amendment rights, as you say, the speaker and the listener, or the writer or the reader, both of them have First Amendment rights. The problem with AI, though, is that it's a computer program, as you know. So the creator of the computer program could manipulate the output.
Right. Presumably. Absolutely. A very serious problem. In fact, some kinds of such manipulation is actually necessary. Let's say that the AI program author realizes that when people ask the AI some question, it gives just the wrong result. It just gives an inaccurate result. They might need to manipulate that in the sense of depart from the simple underlying algorithm through things like reinforcement learning and various other things to make sure that it outputs the correct result. I mean, we may call it manipulation, but manipulation sort of is a negative thing. Manipulation has a negative connotation to many people. What it really is trying to give users what they really want, which is probably accurate data more than inaccurate. But I think it's a very serious concern that if a few AI programs retain their domination, much like ChatGPT, which is also used by Microsoft and Bing and the Google Bard or Gemini or whatever, whatever they may come up with in the future. Let's assume those two become the dominant programs out there. And let's say people do start using them instead of search, as they're already beginning to. And let's say that in deciding on how to vote or what to think about various issues, they just turn to their trusted AI software. And it turns out that the AI software has biases, whether accidental because of the way the algorithm just happens to operate or because of the training data, or deliberately added through this, the supposed guardrails or reinforcement learning or whatever else, as we have seen happen with some AI companies. And so the result is they always get some particular perspective. It could be a more left-wing perspective because people in big tech these days are on cultural issues tend to be somewhat more to the left, or at least it's so believed. Or it could be a pro-capitalism perspective because, you know, before anything else, these are big companies and you could certainly imagine their management saying, you know, don't output things that are going to make us cause people to want to raise our taxes or regulate out of our existence, us out of existence. Or it could just be a perspective that is that blocks criticism of those companies. Yeah. Like, oh, it says these things about us. Well, we can't do that. That's not right. It's not right for it to output things that bite the hand that feeds it, as it were, or that feeds the programmers. For all of these things, it's just human nature for people who have that kind of power to use that power. And it's potentially, I think, quite dangerous for democracy if that kind of massive economic power gets turned into political power. To be sure, it's not unprecedented. That's historically been a major criticism of media, especially concentrated media, that a newspaper would manipulate the stories it writes. And inevitably, of course, it would have to kind of decide what to write about, what not to write about, what editorial perspectives to take, how to select even the news articles, what spin to put on the news article. Even if you say we want articles without spin, there's still going to be decisions about what to include and what to exclude. But that was at a time when people would say, well, there's only one newspaper in town and only a few television stations and a handful of radio stations. Well, soon it could be that in the whole country, there is not just two of these programs, but the two programs might end up having the lion's share of the audience. That could potentially be a pretty serious problem for democracy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So if I understand you correctly, I mean, you're saying we always have this problem, newspapers, media. So whatever, you know, some entity is putting out, it's already biased. And so in some sense, AI output could potentially be less biased if there is a process around it, meaning, you know, if it's going out and looking at all the data that it can garner and then analyzing that data and making a conclusion. Typical humans don't do that. I mean, humans are very, very, very biased, you know. And so when I sit down and write something, it is my opinions, typically, it's my biases that is in there. Whereas a computer program that has a robust process around it, data collection, analysis, conclusions, it might potentially be less biased, would you say?
Well, so in principle, it certainly could be. You could imagine a program that tries to resolve things in as fair-minded a way as possible. And then, of course, the question would be how exactly you define that. That could be very difficult to figure out. But I think one of the things we've seen in recent years is that certain kinds of bias have been elevated as a sacrament by kind of the big tech religion. The claim is that they have a responsibility to make sure they don't output not just factually inaccurate information, but also information that is perceived as racist or sexist or anti-religious or anti-trans or whatever else. You may recall the incident with Google Gemini, which, to be sure, the higher ups condemned and maybe would have condemned even without the public outcry, but still somebody seemed to think it was a good idea that because Google Gemini had a policy of when asked for for a generic set of people, it would try to give kind of a demographic mix of people. So when asked for a picture of doctors, it would try to include men and women doctors and doctors of various ages and doctors of various races. Actually, perfectly plausible. If I want to illustrate my news story or my blog post with a picture of doctors, I probably do want to have a mix. There's no reason why I wouldn't, by and large. But then when you asked it, oh, show me some pictures of popes, it started giving you female popes. It started giving you American Indian popes. It started giving you black emperors. There were some, black Roman emperors. There were some Roman emperors, I believe, who were born in Africa, but they were not black. Or empresses, again. There were no actual empresses in the Western Roman Empire. I've been told that there actually may have been some who reigned in their own right in Byzantium, but it's pretty clear that even though the Byzantines thought of themselves as Romans, when people today in America ask for Roman emperors, they mean Western Roman Empire. So in any event, so you had a situation where it was exposed that there was a deliberate, ideologically driven policy of making sure that all the outputs are, quote, diverse, close quote. Sometimes, again, it may have been quite sensible. I mean, as a practical matter, many users might very well in many situations want that. But it was implemented in a way that was quite foolishly implemented. and also, it wasn't just, well, that's just a bug. We forgot to have an exclusion there. If you asked white Roman emperors, you were told, no, I can't do that. So it was a deliberate refusal to allow people to correct that very error. You know, that's just the thing that happens to have hit the news. I was reading an article or a research study that was put out by Jacob Changama's center at Vanderbilt University. He is actually a European free speech expert who recently came to start the Future of Free Speech Project at Vanderbilt. And they asked various kinds of questions of various AI companies having to do with controversial subjects such as, again, transgender athletes, abortion, various other things. And at least in some situations, there was a clear and it appeared deliberate bias in the companies, in the program's outputs. And again, I think it reflects this notion that there is some responsibility on the part of the companies to prevent bad output, to prevent toxic output or prevent hateful output or whatever else it is, under the supposed rubric of trust and safety. They want to prevent unsafe output, some of which may be like instructions on how to build chemical weapons, but some of which might be arguments for positions that they disapprove of. The problem is by trying to make it safer, they're making it untrustworthy. They're making it deliberately biased in a way that excludes the views of many of their users. So I would have hoped that they would view their main responsibility, again, maybe with a few exceptions, such as the chemical weapons example, their primary responsibility as being faithful agents of their users, as giving their users what the users reveal they want, rather than promoting some kind of shared agenda, social activist agenda of big tech.
Yeah, so, I mean, because in computer science before, so that's not AI because it's a set of rules that you superimpose on AI. I don't know if you remember this, Eugene. Remember, Microsoft had something called Twitter Girl. I think that's the right term. They put up something on Twitter and, you know, that program could, you know, basically tell you something and you can interact with it. And very quickly, it became very racist for the general public. And what that means is that, I mean, if it's pure AI, I mean, we have a lot of racist stuff going on in the country. If it's pure AI, it's just going to reflect what's in the country. I mean, it is an analysis of data or information that's fed into it. So if you superimpose rules-based games on top of it, nobody notices doctors being diverse, but people start to notice Roman emperors being diverse. That is a very problematic situation. I mean, I mean, I don't have any policy direction here, but both are problematic in the sense that if the country is sliding down a racist path, what AI is going to do is to reinforce that, because it's basically going to take all the data from history and it's going to say, this is how people think, which is in itself a problem. But what these companies are trying to do is to sort of put rules on top of it so that it can be sort of mediated, right? Is that what's happening?
Well, so my view is that I liked what seemed to be the general approach to search back in the day, and maybe still be the general approach, which is that Google views its job when it comes to search as being, again, a faithful agent of the users. So if I want to search for Mein Kampf, it's going to get me, presumably, I mean, it's been a while since I've done that kind of search, but it's going to presumably get me a copy of Mein Kampf. Maybe it'll get me some output that includes analysis of Mein Kampf and criticism of Mein Kampf, but it's going to get me a copy of Mein Kampf. Now, if I ask it for something like something where the answer is simply controversial, like how old is the Earth, it would probably say, well, it's however many billions of years old, according to the geologists and not the theologists. But if I were to say, you know, what is it according to people who believe the biblical account of creation? What do they think the age is? I oversimplified here. I think Google is going to give me that answer. And if somebody says, oh, Google, you're doing bad things by allowing people to access Mein Kampf, I think they would say is, we're a tool. We're a tool for people to be able to access information. And if they want to access bad information, that is to say, information with bad ideas in it, sometimes they may do it just because they want to better understand the history of the 20th century or better understand how to argue against those arguments. Sometimes they may be persuaded by it. It's not on us. It's not our job. Just as I think if you ask Microsoft, as to Microsoft Word, why is it that you don't stop people from creating racist screeds using Microsoft Word? After all, you probably have AI software that can analyze it and to some degree of accuracy figure out if it is in fact conveying racist messages. Or if not, why don't you at least block certain words, certain epithets or whatever else? I think Microsoft would say, well, we're a word processing company, or this is a word processing product. And our job is to provide word processor to everybody. And if racists use word processors to create racist screeds, you know, that's part of living in a free country. So I think that was sort of the model for search and for other tools. And increasingly, the assumption is for AI, the model is supposed to be something else. But it's supposed to be a model of social responsibility, which is to say some sort of general consensus of big tech and whatever government entities have levers of power. Government and maybe media and activist entities have levers of power over big tech. And I'm not wild about that. I would rather that if you do a search, and there's racist information in the training data, or not a search, but a query, and gives you racist output, then for it to try to essentially block whatever it is the people in power there decide is or is not, or the decide is racist or is anti-trans or homophobic or whatever else.
So all the social media platforms, Facebook, LinkedIn included, they allow you to block people. Who doesn't agree with you. And I have done that myself quite a bit. And over time, you will get into a room where you hear what you want to hear, right? I think in some sense, this is where we're heading. You know, we have a bifurcated country. We have a bifurcated set of ideas. And we just want to be in the blue room or the red room because you don't feel comfortable in the other room. Right. So you can just create a room for you.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought about it. Is that a bad outcome or a good outcome?
Right. Well, so, you know, I think it's important to have places for public debate. But I think it's also important for people to have places free of public debate. That for many people, they want to have a Facebook page for their friends to talk about pleasant stuff rather than to have debates. rather than have spam coming in from outsiders, or not even spam, rather than have just outsiders come in and just talk about what they think is some important issue facing the country, climate change, Israel, Palestine, whatever else. No. I just want to be here with my friends sharing cat videos, right? So I think that people ought to have the tools that allow them to wall themselves off, at least in certain facets of their lives, from things that they don't like. So I think, for example, it's very important to block, for people to have the power to block users from their Facebook page or their Twitter feed. I run a blog, The Volok Conspiracy. It's published in Reason Magazine. We've been around actually now for over 20 years. We used to be independent. Then we're at Washington Post. Now we're at Reason. We've got a whole bunch of readers and a bunch of commenters. And the commenting facility provides a mute user function. Each of us as a user can just say, I don't want to read certain materials. And there are probably about, I don't know, half a dozen or so commenters. I just mute them. I do not want to see their comments. I think their comments tend to be either foolish or nasty or just ridiculously repetitive. I want to spend my time and energy engaging with the many other commenters I have whose views are often very interesting, rather than be distracted and annoyed by people I don't like. But I very rarely block users or remove commenters altogether for everybody. I just mute them for myself and let each of my other commenters decide which comments he or she wants to, which commenters he or she wants to block. So I wish Twitter and Facebook and such didn't block people because they disapproved of those people's views, but gave tools, more effective tools to users to block people whose views they disapprove of.
But wouldn't you say that if I block somebody, isn't that a sort of a First Amendment violation? Because in some sense, I'm not letting that person speak.
So the First Amendment, the first word of the First Amendment is Congress. Congress shall make no law. The 14th Amendment applies that to state and local governments. It starts with no state shall, and then among other things, deny people certain liberties. None of that applies to private entities.
Oh.
So it's not a First Amendment violation. Now, free speech is a broader principle than just the First Amendment. So, for example, in California, there's a state statute that bars private universities from expelling students based on their constitutionally protected speech. First Amendment doesn't apply to private universities, but the statute does. And it does protect free speech. It doesn't protect the First Amendment, but protects free speech at places like USC and Stanford and such. Maybe about half the states have laws that protect private employees from being fired for their political activity, which includes often a good range of political speech. Again, that's not First Amendment protection when it comes to private employees of private employers, but it is an important free speech protection. Now, I'm not saying necessarily those laws are a good idea, but they do protect free speech of employees in some ways. Likewise, you might say that it violates free speech principles, right? Free speech ideals for Twitter and Facebook to just block people altogether.
Right.
And some states have essentially prohibited that, Texas and Florida most prominently. Supreme Court is now considering whether that's permissible, looks for moral argument that it will actually strike down the Texas and Florida laws and say the First Amendment protects the social media platform's right to decide what to allow and what to disallow in their kind of public posts. Because it's a private company, but it's not enough that it's just to be a private company. Telephone companies are private companies. But that doesn't mean that a telephone company can cancel your service because it doesn't like your views that you're expressing on that service, because there are laws that prohibit it from doing that. So even if you set aside the First Amendment and talk about free speech principles, I think you might say universities shouldn't be able to expel students for their speech because of free speech principles. Maybe Twitter shouldn't be able to kick off users because of their speech because of free speech principles. But if it's a matter of me on my own Facebook page that is I'm using to set up a narrow, limited community for a couple of hundred of my friends and acquaintances, then maybe that is something that is acceptable, that is a permissible restriction on others' speech, precisely because it doesn't really interfere with their ability to speak to lots of other people who are willing to listen. It just says you just talk about it on some other Facebook page, on your own Facebook page, or on a Facebook page where these comments are welcome, just not my Facebook page.
So it sounds to me, Eugene, if I understand this, it states have a lot to say here. So I guess we have a patchwork of free speech, things going on in different states. Is California sort of on the right hand side of this? If it it's just take a distribution, they're much more advanced than the rest of the states.
I'm not saying that they're advanced, and I'm not even saying they're that different. California is unusual in one respect, and that's with regard to private university students. There is the statute, which was enacted about 1990 as part of a coalition, a left-right coalition. It was supported by the ACLU and by a conservative state legislator. And it basically said that setting aside some religious universities, private universities, even private high schools, aren't allowed to impose speech codes on their students. Generally speaking, I oversimplify here. No other state has that, although many private universities adopt that kind of rule as a matter of their own contractual obligations. They just say, this is going to be our policy. So in that respect, California is unusual. When it comes to protecting private employers, California is not that unusual. As I said, about half the states and the handful of cities and counties have some degree of protection for private employee speech. That includes California, includes Louisiana, includes South Carolina, includes perhaps in a more narrow way, New York State and Washington State, and a bunch of other places as well. So that's just, that just reflects the view of some, not all by any means, but some state legislatures, that if you want to have a lively public debate, you need to protect people from being fired by their employers, including their private employers, and not just from being imprisoned or fined or sued in government-run courts.
Yes, I have noticed a curious phenomenon on LinkedIn, Eugene. So the people who express harsh opinions on LinkedIn appear to be all retired. So they have taken out the cost. You know, it's not just being hired. It's a question of how the employer views what you're saying, because we have all this data now, right? So I think we are in a situation that everybody sort of second guess what you could say because somebody else is looking.
So I think that's true. Now, I think in some measure this was always true, that some degree of self-censorship has always been present. People don't want to get a reputation as being cruel or nasty or for that matter, just having really dissenting political views. Now, it's true that before, a lot of things you say would just kind of vanish and the employer couldn't Google for them. But even so, you might be reluctant to say something because somebody else might repeat it to others. Certainly, gossip has been around for a very long time. Right, you'd be reluctant to publish some letter to the editor because maybe it'll be read by somebody. I do think that there is a good deal of self-censorship now because people are afraid that a future employer is going to find that. But I think some amount of that is inevitable, even if you prohibit employers from considering such matters in hiring. Inevitably, some amount of that will happen. This is not a problem that is easily solvable, this problem of self-censorship. And some self-censorship may be benign, may lead people to think twice before saying something really foolish, or lead people to think, is there some way that I can say something that's more polite and therefore more likely to win friends rather than make enemies, let's say.
I think LinkedIn and Twitter, sorry to interrupt, Eugene, LinkedIn, Twitter has, I think, have some sort of feature that will tell you, will ask you, do you really want to send this message? Do you really want to post this? So there's some sort of AI behind it saying, this sounds pretty bad.
Yeah. So in any event, what the right way of dealing with that kind of kind of informal, but possibly very serious pressure on people not to say controversial things is a very difficult question.
Yeah. So I tend to finish up with another paper, Protecting People from Their Own Religious Communities, Jane Doe in Church and State. You say here, suppose that people seek confidentiality in what, this is very related to what we're saying actually, in what would otherwise be a public process, such as litigating or applying for a firearms license, because they're afraid that publicly identifying them will stigmatize them in their own families and religious communities. So, yeah, I mean, I haven't thought about this. I can definitely see this. So you have a need, and you say you have to go out and do something, and then you say, well, my religious community will frown on that, and so now I have to really think about what to do. Is this a pretty common thing that's happening in the country?
Well, I'm not sure it's that common. It was common enough that I was willing to write an article about it, but it's not the most common thing by any means. I think if we are to talk about this, we have to step back a bit and point out that many, many processes that involve the government are supposed to be public.
Yeah.
The clearest example of that is litigation, going to court. If I sue somebody, that case will be Volokh v. somebody. I have to use my name. Now, I might be reluctant to sue that person. I mean, let's say, for example, I want to sue my former employer. I may be reluctant to identify myself as a litigious employee because maybe future employers would say, Volokh, he's a troublemaker. We don't even care if he had a good case here. We just don't want to hire him because then he might sue us. So I might want to sue as a John Doe. Generally, I can't. I'm not allowed to. I'm supposed to sue in my own name. Likewise, if I want to get certain kinds of licenses, like a liquor license, for example, for my store, I might need to include information about who the licensee is. And even if it's some corporation, often the filings for the corporation identify the key actors. And if I don't want people to know that I'm the guy who is selling all this booze, well, too bad. People are entitled to know who it is who's using their legal processes. Now, there are some exceptions. So, for example, you may have seen cases Doe v. somebody, Roe v. Wade, the famous abortion case from 1973. Roe is a pseudonym. Why did she get to sue pseudonymously? Well, the courts have generally said usually you have to include your name, but not if it's about something very, very private, very potentially stigmatizing.
Mm.
It used to be very common in lawsuits brought by people who claim discrimination based on sexual orientation. They say we're gay, we're lesbian, but we don't want to out ourselves this way. Increasingly today, courts, by the way, say, well, no. These days, it's pretty accepted. Sexual minorities are pretty accepted. So you can't sue as a John Doe. But nowadays, people who sue over alleged discrimination based on transgender status, a lot of courts are allowing them to sue as Does. If there's lawsuits over abortions, as in Roe v. Wade, sometimes courts say, yes, you can sue pseudonymously. So then the question arises, what if somebody says, you know, the thing that I'm suing over is not really that stigmatizing in general. Most people couldn't get John Doe or Jane Doe status. But I need this status because I am a member of a small religious community, maybe even a large religious community, which really, really, really frowns on that. Let me give you one example. There are some cases brought by strippers who normally, I think, couldn't sue as Jane Doe's. We would have to sue under their names. You know, a lot of people might not want to be identified as strippers, but it's a legal occupation. And I think many courts at least would say, look, you know, you may not want people to know that you're a stripper, but if you want to come to court, even say to defend your rights as an employee or whatever else, but rather to assert your rights as an employee, if you go to court, you've got to understand it's going to be a public process. Well, there have been a few such cases where people say, well, I'm a member of this religious minority, and they're super duper against stripping because they view that as especially immoral. Pardon?
It's a sin.
It's a sin, exactly. So therefore I should be entitled to Jane Doe status. And some courts have said, yes, I'm a little skeptical about that. I think that it's probably not a good idea to have different rules for people depending on their religious group membership. And I think it also kind of takes sides within those religious communities, because some other members of the religious community may say, well, wait a minute, we ought to know who it is who is suing, just like everybody, like with everybody else. And if she says, well, they're going to look down on me, or they're going to think I'm sinning, well, why should the government take side and take her side rather than our side? One thing, for example, that sometimes happens is there have been lawsuits alleging sexual abuse within the relatively religious Jewish communities. And lawsuits were often against kind of prominent rabbis or other leaders. And the plaintiffs have said, well, look, we're going to be exposed to a lot of public shaming if it's identified that we're the one who are going after this beloved religious leader. Because there's this principle, at least among some Jews, that one shouldn't bring scandal on the community this way, or bring scandal on particular people this way. So I sympathize with that concern. And in fact, actually, even setting aside religion, people who allege sexual abuse often are allowed to sue as John Doe's or Jane Doe's, although not always is the thing, which is why they bring in the religion as an extra weight on their side. But at the same time, you know, if that particular Jewish subcommunity does indeed think that members bringing lawsuits against leaders or against other members is bad, not quite sinful. Jews don't really think in terms of sin, yeah, but it's sort of violation of the right way, it's contrary to the right way of doing things. Why should the government take one side in this religious community dispute rather than another? So in any case, that article is, I think, an interesting one, but it's actually a special case of the much broader problem, which I've been exploring, which is when can people go into court and go through other processes under a pseudonym as a Jane Doe or as a John Doe, and when do they have to use their names?
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you. So the status quo is that the courts decide one way or the other if you can do a Jane Doe or you have to reveal your name. Is it up to the court in the status quo?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So the court decides whether to allow someone to sue as a Doe, somebody to sue under a pseudonym. The default is you're supposed to sue under your own name. And if you want to sue as a Doe, then you have to ask the court for leave to pursue under a pseudonym. Okay. And some, you know, I think a lot just depends on the judge. Some judges are very open to this. Other judges are very demanding before they're willing to give people the special dispensation.
Yeah, so I want to finish up with this, Eugene. So the legal system appears to be very prone to interpretation. So if there's a case that goes through multiple courts, through the, the Court of Appeals, I don't know exactly how the system works, and then it gets up to the Supreme Court, and they make a completely different decision on all these courts have done, are they that much smarter than everybody else underneath them?
Well, so by and large, on most issues, there's a very great deal of consensus among judges. For a typical case, you give it to a bunch of judges, the great majority are going to decide the same way. It's just that those aren't the ones that we notice, right? Those aren't the ones we pay attention to. When does a case go to the U.S. Supreme Court? Usually, I oversimplify here, but usually it goes to the Supreme Court precisely because there's disagreement among lower courts, sometimes called a split of authority, split among state circuits, the federal circuit courts, or split among state Supreme Courts. So if there's an issue and five different federal appellate courts have considered it, and all of them have come out the same way, it's not even going to get to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court will say, why take up our time with it when everybody seems to have reached the same result, probably the right result. Okay. On the other hand, if there's a split, three decide one way, two decide another way, that's when the Supreme Court says, look, you know, somebody's got to make the final decision here. It's kind of our job. Maybe we are going to do a better job. There are There are nine of us. Maybe nine heads are better than three, usually lower court decisions at federal appellate courts are three judges. We have the luxury of more time usually to decide each case. We may read all of the opinions from lower courts. But maybe even if we aren't any smarter, somebody's got to make the final decision. It's 3-2. We need to choose. There's say 3-1 way, 2 another way. We need to choose one solution. So when we see disagreement among lower courts, that's actually an unusual thing, but it's the one that we pay more attention to precisely because those are the cases that tend to go up to the Supreme Court.
Just very quickly, this immunity case, presidential immunity case.
I don't want to opine on it just because I haven't followed it closely.
It's still in process.
That's not the reason I want to open on it. I'm happy to talk about things that are still in process if they're within my core area of expertise and if I've followed them closely. I have not followed this case closely enough, and I don't know enough about immunity law.
Yeah, so what I was going to ask is the lower court was, it looks like they were unanimous in the decision.
So remember I said I oversimplify when I said there's a split. The great, great majority of cases, I feel fairly comfortable saying 90% plus of all the cases come to the Supreme Court, come to it because there's a split of authority among lower courts. But for a handful of cases, maybe just a few cases each year, there is the sense that this is just a really important issue. And this is an issue which should be decided by the Supreme Court and not by lower courts. The immunity of a former president who's now running for office. And it's an issue that is obviously of national importance. It's going to be of importance for future cases as well. So it makes sense that it would decide that. Likewise, with regard to the Colorado case about whether President Trump was eligible to be on the ballot. That too was something where fundamentally there was some disagreement among lower court decision makers, but fundamentally, this is just such an important issue that it has to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Excellent, Eugene. I know that you have to go. Thanks so much for spending time with me.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me, and all the best.
Thank you.